All do so except the people of Mydros. Mydros prepares to perform his oath, though now at last weighed down by sorrow because of it. He sends to Fionnwë, reminding him of the oath and begging for the Silmarils. Fionnwë replies that he has lost his right to them because of the evil deeds of Feanor, and of the slaying of Dior, and of the plundering of Sirion. He must submit and come back to Valinor. In Valinor only and at the judgment of the gods shall they be handed over. On the last march, Maglor says to Mydros that there are two sons of Feanor left, and two Silmarils. One is his. He steals it and flies, but it burns him so that he knows he no longer has a right to it. He wanders in pain over the earth and casts it into a fiery pit. One Silmaril is now in the sea, and one in the earth. Maglor sings now ever in sorrow by the sea. The judgment of the gods takes place. The earth is to be for men, and the elves who do not set sail for the Lonely Isle or Valinor shall slowly fade and fail. For a while the last dragons and orcs shall grieve the earth, but in the end all shall perish by the valour of men. Morgoth is thrust through the door of night into the outer dark beyond the walls of the world, and a guard set forever on that door. The lies that he sowed in the hearts of men and elves do not die, and cannot all be slain by the gods, but live on and bring much evil even to this day. Some say also that secretly Morgoth or his black shadow and spirit, in spite of the Valar, creeps back over the walls of the world in the north and east and visits the world. Others that this is Thu, his great chief, who escaped the last battle and dwells still in dark places, and perverts men to his dreadful worship. When the world is much older and the gods weary, Morgoth will come back through the door, and the last battle of all will be fought. Fionnwë will fight Morgoth on the plain of Valinor, and the spirit of Turin shall be beside him. It shall be Turin who with his black sword will slay Morgoth, and thus the children of Húrin shall be avenged. In those days the Silmarils shall be recovered from sea and earth and air, and Mydros shall break them, and Pelurian with their fire rekindle the two trees, and the great light shall come forth again, and the mountains of Valinor shall be levelled so that it goes out over the world, and gods and elves shall grow young again, and all their dead awake. But of men in that day the prophecy speaks not. And thus it was that the last Silmaril came into the air. The gods adjudged the last Silmaril to Eärendil, until many things shall come to pass, because of the deeds of the sons of Feanor. Mydros is sent to Eärendil, and with the aid of the Silmaril, Elwing is found and restored. Eärendil's boat is drawn over Valinor to the outer seas, and Eärendil launches it into the outer darkness, high above sun and moon. There he sails with the Silmaril upon his brow, and Elwing at his side, the brightest of all stars, keeping watch upon Morgoth and the door of night. So he shall sail until he sees the last battle gathering upon the plains of Valinor. Then he will descend. And this is the last end of the tales of the days before the days in the northern regions of the Western world.
It would take this story very much too far afield to enter into any general discussion of this most complex and obscure part of the history of the First Age, its end. I will only mention a few aspects of the narrative in the sketch of the mythology given here. What little writing on the subject that survives from the earliest period of my father's work had very largely been abandoned, and the account in the sketch is effectively the first witness to wholly new features, among which is the emergence of the fate of the Silmarils as a central element in the story of the final war. This is borne out by a question that my father asked himself in a very early isolated note. What became of the Silmarils after the capture of Melkor? Indeed, it may well be said that the very existence of the Silmarils was of far less radical significance in the original conception of the mythology than it was to become. In the account in the sketch, Maglor says to Maedhros that there are two sons of Fëanor left, and two Silmarils. One is his. The third is lost, because it has been told in the sketch that Elwing cast the now Glafring into the sea and leapt after it. That was the Silmaril of Beren and Lúthien. When Maglor cast into a fiery pit the Silmaril from the Iron Crown that he had stolen from the keeping of Fionwë, one Silmaril was now in the sea and one in the earth. The third was the other from the Iron Crown, and it was this that the gods adjudged to Eärendil, who, wearing it upon his brow, launched it into the outer darkness high above sun and moon. That it was the Silmaril, wrested by Beren and Lúthien from Morgoth in Angband, that Eärendil wore and became the morning and evening star, had not been achieved at this stage, though when achieved it seems a necessity of the myth. It is also very striking that Eärendil half-elven is not, as yet, the voice that interceded before the Valar on behalf of men and elves. The conclusion of the Quenta Noldorinwa. I take up this second citation of the Quenta from the point at which the first citation ended, where it was told that the elves who survived the destruction of Doriath and of Gondolin became a small people of shipbuilders at the mouths of Sirion, where they dwelt ever nigh unto the shores and under the shadow of Ulmo's hand. I give now the Quenta to its end, following as before the rewritten text, Q2.
In Valinor, Ulmo spoke unto the Valar of the need of the elves, and he called on them to forgive and send succour unto them, and rescue them from the overmastering might of Morgoth, and win back the Silmarils, wherein alone now bloomed the light of the days of bliss when the two trees still were shining. Or so it is said among the gnomes, who after had tidings of many things from their kinsfolk the Quendi, the light elves beloved of Manwë, who ever knew something of the mind of the Lord of the Gods. But as yet Manwë moved not, and the counsels of his heart what tale shall tell. The Quendi have said that the hour was not yet come, and that only one speaking in person for the cause of both elves and men, pleading for pardon upon their misdeeds and pity on their woes, might move the counsels of the powers. And the oath of Fëanor perchance even Manwë could not loose until it found its end, and the sons of Fëanor relinquished the Silmarils, upon which they had laid their ruthless claim. For the light which lit the Silmarils the gods had made. In those days Tuor felt old age creep upon him, and ever a longing for the deeps of the sea grew stronger in his heart. Wherefore he built a great ship, Eärame, Eagle's Pinion, and with Idril he set sail into the sunset and the west, and came no more into any tale or song.
A later addition was, but Tuor alone of mortal men was numbered among the elder race, and joined with the Noldori whom he loved, and in after time dwelt still, or so it hath been said, ever upon his ship voyaging the seas of the elven lands, or resting a while in the harbours of the gnomes of Tull Eressëa, and his fate is sundered from the fate of men.
Bright Eärendil was then lord of the folk of Sirion and their many ships, and he took to wife Elwing the Fair, and she bore him Elrond half-elven,
later changed to Elrond and Elros, who are called the half-elven.
Yet Eärendil could not rest, and his voyages about the shores of the Hitherlands, or Middle-earth, eased not his unquiet. Two purposes grew in his heart, blended as one in longing for the wide sea. He sought to sail thereon, seeking after Tuor and Idril Celebrimbor, who returned not. And he thought to find perhaps the last shore, and bring, ere he died, the message of elves and men unto the Valar of the West, that should move the hearts of Valinor and of the elves of Tún to pity on the world and the sorrows of mankind. Wingerlot he built, fairest of the ships of song, the foam flower. White were its timbers as the argent moon, golden were its oars, silver were its shrouds, its masts were crowned with jewels like stars. In the lay of Eärendil is many a thing sung of his adventures in the deep and in lands untrodden, and in many seas and many isles. Ungoliant in the south he slew, and her darkness was destroyed, and light came to many regions which had yet long been hid. But Elwing sat sorrowing at home. Eärendil found not Tuor nor Idril, nor came he ever on that journey to the shores of Valinor, defeated by shadows and enchantment, driven by repelling winds, until in longing for Elwing he turned him homeward toward the east. And his heart bade him haste, for a sudden fear was fallen on him out of dreams, and the winds that before he had striven with might not now bear him back as swift as his desire. Upon the havens of Sirion new woe had fallen. The dwelling of Elwing there, where she still possessed the Nauglamir and the glorious Silmaril, became known unto the remaining sons of Feanor, Maedros and Maglor and Damrod and Diriel. And they gathered together from their wandering hunting paths, and messages of friendship and yet stern demand they sent unto Sirion. But Elwing and the folk of Sirion would not yield that jewel which Beren had won and Luthien had worn, and for which Dior the Fair was slain, and least of all while Eärendil their lord was in the sea. For it seemed to them that in that jewel lay the gift of bliss and healing that had come upon their houses and their ships. And so came in the end to pass the last and cruelest of the slayings of elf by elf. And that was the third of the great wrongs achieved by the accursed oath. For the sons of Feanor came down upon the exiles of Gondolin and the remnant of Doriath, and destroyed them. Though some of their folk stood aside, and some few rebelled and were slain upon the other part, aiding Elwing against their own lords, for such was the sorrow and confusion of the hearts of Elfiness in those days, yet Maedros and Maglor won the day. Alone they now remained of the sons of Feanor, for in that battle Damrod and Diriel were slain. But the folk of Sirion perished or fled away, or departed of need to join the people of Maedros, who claimed now the lordship of all the elves of the hitherlands. And yet Maedros gained not the Silmaril. For Elwing, seeing that all was lost and her child Elrond taken captive, eluded the host of Maedros, and with the Nauglamir upon her breast, she cast herself into the sea and perished, as folk thought. But Ulmo bore her up, and he gave unto her the likeness of a great white bird, and upon her breast there shone as a star the shining Silmaril, as she flew over the water to seek Eärendil, her beloved. And on a time of night, Eärendil at the helm saw her come towards him, as a white cloud under moon exceeding swift, as a star over the sea moving in strange course, a pale flame on wings of storm. And it is sung that she fell from the air upon the timbers of Wingerlot in a swoon, nigh unto death for the urgency of her speed, and Eärendil took her unto his bosom. And in the morn with marvelling eyes he beheld his wife in her own form beside him with her hair upon his face. And she slept. But great was the sorrow of Eärendil and Elwing for the ruin of the havens of Sirion, and the captivity of their son, for whom they feared death. And yet it was not so. For Maedros took pity on Elrond, and he cherished him, and love grew after between them, as little might be thought. But Maedros' heart was sick and weary with the burden of the dreadful oath.
This passage was rewritten thus. But great was the sorrow of Eärendil and Elwing for the ruin of the havens of Sirion, and the captivity of their sons, and they feared that they would be slain. But it was not so, for Maglor took pity on Elros and Elrond, and he cherished them, and love grew after between them, as little might be thought, But Maglor's heart was sick and weary, etc.
Yet Eärendil saw now no help left in the lands of Sirion. And he turned again in despair and came not home, but sought back once more to Valinor with Elwing at his side. He stood now most often at the prow, and the Silmaril he bound upon his forehead, and ever its light grew greater as they drew unto the west. Maybe it was due in part to the puissance of that holy jewel, that they came in time to the waters that as yet no vessel save those of the Teleri had known. And they came unto the magic isles and escaped their magic, and they came into the shadowy seas and passed their shadows, and they looked upon the lonely isle, and they tarried not there, and they cast anchor in the Bay of Faerie,
later changed to Bay of Elvenholm,
upon the borders of the world. And the Teleri saw the coming of that ship and were amazed, gazing from afar upon the light of the Silmaril, and it was very great. But Eärendil landed on the immortal shores alone of living men, and neither Elwing nor any of his small company would he suffer to go with him, lest they fell beneath the wrath of the gods. And he came at a time of festival, even as Morgoth and Ungoliant had in ages past. And the watchers upon the hill of Tun were few, for the Quendi were most in the halls of Manwë, on Tinbrenting's height. The watchers rode therefore in haste to Valmar, or hid them in the passes of the hills, and all the bells of Valmar pealed. But Eärendil climbed the marvellous hill of Kor and found it bare, and he entered into the streets of Tun, and they were empty, and his heart sank. He walked now in the deserted ways of Tun, and the dust upon his raiment and his shoes was a dust of diamonds, yet no one heard his call. Wherefore he went back unto the shores and would climb once more upon Wingerlot his ship. But one came unto the strand and cried unto him, "Hail, Eärendil, star most radiant, messenger most fair! Hail, thou bearer of light before the sun and moon, the looked-for that comest unawares, the longed-for that comest beyond hope! Hail, thou splendour of the children of the world, thou slayer of the dark! Star of the sunset, hail! Hail! Herald of the Morn!" And that was Fionwë, the son of Manwë, and he summoned Eärendil before the gods. And Eärendil went unto Valinor, and to the halls of Valmar, and came never again back into the lands of men. But Eärendil spoke the embassy of the two kindreds before the faces of the gods, and asked for pardon upon the gnomes, and pity for the exiled elves, and for unhappy men, and succour in their need. Then the sons of the Valar prepared for battle, and the captain of their host was Fionwë, son of Manwë. Beneath his white banner marched also the host of the Quendi, the Light Elves, the folk of Ingwë, and among them such of the gnomes of old as had never departed from Valinor. But remembering Swanhaven, the Teleri went not forth save very few, and these manned the ships wherewith the most of that army came into the northern lands. But they themselves would set foot never on those shores. Eärendil was their guide, but the gods would not suffer him to return again. And he built him a white tower upon the confines of the outer world, in the northern regions of the sundering seas, and there all the sea-birds of the earth at times repaired. And often was Elwing in the form and likeness of a bird, and she devised wings for the ship of Eärendil, and it was lifted even into the oceans of the air. Marvellous and magical was that ship, a starlit flower in the sky, bearing a wavering and holy flame, and the folk of earth beheld it from afar and wondered, and looked up from despair, saying, "Surely a Silmaril is in the sky. A new star is risen in the west." Maedhros said unto Maglor,
"The preceding passage, beginning Eärendil was their guide, was rewritten thus. In those days the ship of Eärendil was drawn by the gods beyond the edge of the world, and it was lifted even into the oceans of the air. Marvellous and magical was that ship, a starlit flower in the sky. bearing a wavering and holy flame. And the folk of earth beheld it from afar and wondered, and looked up from despair, saying, Surely a Silmaril is in the sky, a new star is risen in the west. But Elwing mourned for Arendel, yet found him never again, and they are sundered till the world endeth. Therefore she built a white tower upon the confines of the outer world in the northern regions of the sundering seas, and there all the sea-birds of the earth at times repaired. And Elwing devised wings for herself, and desired to fly to Arendel's ship. But, then this is followed by some illegible words, which may be, she fell back. But when the flame of it appeared on high, Maglor said unto Maedhros,
If that be the Silmaril that riseth by some power divine out of the sea into which we saw it fall, then let us be glad that its glory is seen now by many. Thus hope arose and a promise of betterment, but Morgoth was filled with doubt. Yet it is said that he looked not for the assault that came upon him from the west. So great was his pride become that he deemed none would ever again come against him in open war. Moreover, he thought that he had estranged forever the gnomes from the gods and from their kin, and that content in their blissful realm, the Valar would heed no more his kingdom in the world without. For heart that is pitiless counteth not the power that pity hath, of which stern anger may be forged, and a lightning kindled before which mountains fall. Of the march of the host of Fionnwë to the north little is said, for in his armies came none of those elves who had dwelt and suffered in the hither lands, and who made these tales. And tidings only long after did they learn of these things from their kinsfolk, the light elves of Valinor. But Fionnwë came, and the challenge of his trumpets filled the sky, and he summoned unto him all men and elves from Hithlum unto the east, and Beleriand was ablaze with the glory of his arms, and the mountains rang. The meeting of the hosts of the west and of the north is named the Great Battle, the Battle Terrible, the Battle of Wrath and Thunder. There was marshalled the whole power of the Throne of Hate, and well-nigh measureless had it become, so that Dor na Fauglith could not contain it, and all the north was aflame with war. But it availed not. All the Balrogs were destroyed, and the uncounted hosts of the orcs perished like straw in fire, or were swept like shrivelled leaves before a burning wind. Few remained to trouble the world thereafter. And it is said that there many men of Hithlum, repentant of their evil servitude, did deeds of valour, and many beside of men new come out of the east, and so were fulfilled in part the words of Ulmo. For by Earendel, son of Tuor, was help brought unto the elves, and by the swords of men were they strengthened on the fields of war.
A later addition here. But most men, and especially those new come out of the east, were on the side of the enemy.
But Morgoth quailed, and he came not forth, and he loosed his last assault, and that was the winged dragons.
Again, added later, for as yet had none of these creatures of his cruel thought assailed the air.
So sudden and so swift and ruinous was the onset of that fleet, as a tempest of 100 thunders winged with steel, that Fionnwë was driven back. But Earendel came, and a myriad of birds were about him, and the battle lasted all through the night of doubt. And Earendel slew Ancalagon the Black, and the mightiest of all the dragon horde, and cast him from the sky, and in his fall the towers of Thangorodrim were thrown down. Then the sun rose of the second day, and the sons of the Valar prevailed, and all the dragons were destroyed save two alone, and they fled into the east. Then were all the pits of Morgoth broken and unroofed, and the might of Fionnwë descended into the deeps of the earth, and there Morgoth was thrown down.
The words, and there Morgoth was thrown down, were rejected and replaced by this passage. And there Morgoth stood at last at bay, and yet not valiant. he fled unto the deepest of his mines and sued for peace and pardon. But his feet were hewn from under him, and he was hurled upon his face.
He was bound with the chain Angainor, which long had been prepared, and his iron crown they beat into a collar for his neck, and his head was bowed unto his knees. But Fionwe took the two Silmarils that remained and guarded them. Thus perished the power and woe of Angband in the north, and its multitude of thralls came forth beyond all hope into the light of day, and they looked upon a world all changed. For so great was the fury of those adversaries that the northern regions of the western world were rent and riven, and the sea roared in through many chasms, and there was confusion and great noise, and the rivers perished or found new paths, and the valleys were upheaved, and the hills trod down, and Sirion was no more. Then men fled away, such as perished not in the ruin of those days, and long was it ere they came back over the mountains to where Beleriand once had been, and not until the tale of those wars had faded to an echo seldom heard. But Fionwe marched through the western lands, summoning the remnants of the gnomes, and the dark elves that had yet not looked on Valinor, to join with the thralls released and to depart. But Maedhros would not hearken, and he prepared, though with weary loathing and despair, to perform even yet the obligation of his oath. For Maedhros and Maglor would have given battle for the Silmarils, were they withheld, even against the victorious host of Valinor, and though they stood alone in all the world. And they sent unto Fionwe, and bade him yield now up those jewels which of old Morgoth stole from Feanor. But Fionwe said that the right to the work of their hands which Feanor and his sons had formerly possessed now had perished, because of their many and evil deeds blinded by their oath, and most of all the slaying of Dior and the assault upon Elwing. The light of the Silmarils should go now to the gods whence it came, and to Valinor must Maedhros and Maglor return, and there abide the judgment of the gods, by whose decree alone would Fionwe yield the jewels from his charge. Maglor was minded to submit, for he was sad at heart, and he said, "The oath says not that we may not bide our time, and maybe in Valinor all shall be forgiven and forgot, and we shall come into our own." But Maedhros said that if once they returned and the favour of the gods were withheld from them, then would their oath still remain, to be fulfilled in despair yet greater. "And who can tell to what dreadful doom we shall come if we disobey the powers in their own land, or purpose ever to bring war again into their guarded realm?" And so it came that Maedhros and Maglor crept into the camps of Fionwe, and laid hands on the Silmarils, and slew the guards, and there they prepared to defend themselves to the death. But Fionwe stayed his folk, and the brethren departed and fled far away. Each took a single Silmaril, saying that one was lost unto them, and two remained, and but two brethren. But the jewel burned the hand of Maedhros in pain unbearable, and he had but one hand, as has before been told. And he perceived that it was as Fionwe had said, and that his right thereto had become void, and that the oath was vain. And being in anguish and despair, he cast himself into a gaping chasm filled with fire, and so ended. And his Silmaril was taken into the bosom of the earth. And it is told also of Maglor that he could not bear the pain with which the Silmaril tormented him, and he cast it at last into the sea, and thereafter wandered ever upon the shore, singing in pain and regret beside the waves. For Maglor was the mightiest of the singers of old, but he came never back among the folk of Elfines. In those days there was a mighty building of ships on the shores of the western sea, and especially upon the great isles, which in the disruption of the northern world were fashioned of ancient Beleriand. Thence in many a fleet the survivors of the gnomes and of the western companies of the dark elves set sail into the west, and came not again into the lands of weeping and of war. But the light elves marched back beneath the banners of their king, following in the train of Fionwë's victory, and they were borne back in triumph unto Valinor.
Later edition. Yet little joy had they in their return, for they came without the Silmarils, and these could not be again found, unless the world was broken and remade anew.
But in the west, the gnomes and dark elves rehabited for the most part the lonely isle that looks both east and west. And very fair did that land become, and so remains. But some returned even unto Valinor, as all were free to do who willed. And the gnomes were admitted again to the love of Manwë and the pardon of the Valar, and the Teleri forgave their ancient grief, and the curse was laid to rest. Yet not all would forsake the outer lands where they had long suffered and long dwelt. And some lingered many an age in the west and north, and especially in the western isles. And among these were Maglor, as has been told, and with him Elrond the half-elven, who after went among mortal men again, and from whom alone the blood of the firstborn and the seed divine of Valinor have come among mankind. For he was son of Elwing, daughter of Dior, son of Luthien, child of Thingol and Melian. And Eärendil his sire was son of Idril Celebrimdal, the fair maid of Gondolin. But ever as the ages drew on and the elf folk faded on the earth, they would still set sail at eve from our western shores, as still they do, when now there linger few anywhere of their lonely companies. This was the judgment of the gods when Fionwë and the sons of the Valar had returned unto Valmar. Thereafter the outer lands should be for mankind, the younger children of the world. But to the elves alone should the gateways of the west stand ever open. And if they would not come thither and tarried in the world of men, then they should slowly fade and fail. This is the most grievous of the fruits of the lies and works that Morgoth wrought, that the Eldalië should be sundered and estranged from men. For a while his orcs and his dragons breeding again in dark places affrighted the world, and in sundry regions do so yet. But ere the end, all shall perish by the valour of mortal men. But Morgoth, the gods, thrust through the door of timeless night into the void, beyond the walls of the world, and a guard is set forever on that door, and Eärendil keeps watch upon the ramparts of the sky. Yet the lies that Melko, Moeleg the mighty, and accursed Morgoth Bauglier the dark power terrible, sowed in the hearts of elves and men, have not all died, and cannot by the gods be slain. And they live to work much evil, even to this later day. Some say also that Morgoth, at whiles secretly as a cloud that cannot be seen or felt, and yet is venomous, creeps back surmounting the walls and visiteth the world. But others say that this is the black shadow of Thu, whom Morgoth made, and who escaped from the battle terrible, and dwells in dark places and perverts men to his dreadful allegiance and his foul worship.
This passage from But Others Say was rewritten thus. But others say that this is the black shadow of Sauron, who served Morgoth and became the greatest and most evil of his underlings. And Sauron escaped from the great battle and dwelt in dark places and perverted men to his dreadful allegiance and his foul worship.
After the triumph of the gods, Eärendil sailed still in the seas of heaven, but the sun scorched him, and the moon hunted him in the sky. Then the Valar drew his white ship Wingerlot over the land of Valinor, and they filled it with radiance and hallowed it, and launched it through the door of night. And long Eärendil set sail into the starless vast.
The phrase Elwing at his side was here struck out.
The Silmaril upon his brow, voyaging the dark behind the world, a glimmering and fugitive star. And ever and anon he returns and shines behind the courses of the sun and moon above the ramparts of the gods, brighter than all other stars, the mariner of the sky, keeping watch against Morgoth upon the confines of the world. Thus shall he sail until he sees the last battle fought upon the plains of Valinor. Thus spoke the prophecy of Mandos, which he declared in Valmar at the judgment of the gods, and the rumour of it was whispered among all the elves of the West. When the world is old and the powers grow weary, then Morgoth shall come back through the door out of the timeless night, and he shall destroy the sun and the moon. But Eärendil shall come upon him as a white flame and drive him from the airs. Then shall the last battle be gathered on the fields of Valinor. In that day Tulkas shall strive with Melko, and on his right shall stand Fionwë, and on his left Turin Turambar, son of Húrin, conqueror of fate. And it shall be the black sword of Turin that deals unto Melko his death and final end. And so shall the children of Húrin and all men be avenged. Thereafter shall the Silmarils be recovered out of sea and earth and air. For Eärendil shall descend and yield up that flame that he hath had in keeping. Then Fëanor shall bear the three, and yield them unto Yavanna Palurian. And she will break them, and with their fire rekindle the two trees. And a great light shall come forth, and the mountains of Valinor shall be levelled, so that the light goes out over all the world. In that light the gods will again grow young, and the elves awake, and all their dead arise, and the purpose of Ilúvatar be fulfilled concerning them. Such is the end of the tales of the days before the days in the northern regions of the western world.
My History of a History thus ends with a prophecy, the prophecy of Mandos. I will end the book with a repetition of what I wrote in my edition of the great tale of the children of Húrin. It is to be borne in mind that at that time the Quenta Noldorinwa represented, if only in a somewhat bare structure, the full extent of my father's imagined world. It was not the history of the First Age, as it afterwards became, for there was as yet no Second Age, nor Third Age. There was no Numenor, no hobbits, and of course no ring. Additional notes. Ainur. The name Ainur, translated the Holy Ones, derives from my father's myth of the creation of the world. He set down the original conception, according to a letter of 1964, from which I have cited a passage in the prologue, when, at Oxford, he was employed on the staff of the then incomplete Great Dictionary, from 1918 to 20. In Oxford, the letter continues, I wrote a cosmogonical myth, The Music of the Ainur, defining the relation of the One, the Transcendental Creator, to the Valar, the Powers, the angelical first created, and their part in ordering and carrying out the primeval design. It may seem an excessive departure from the tale of the fall of Gondolin to his myth of the creation of the world, but I hope it will soon be apparent why I have made it. The central conception of the cosmogonical myth is declared in the title, The Music of the Ainur. It was not until the 1930s that my father composed a further version, the Ainulindale, the Music of the Ainur, in substance closely following the original text. It is from this version that I have taken the quotations in the very brief account that follows. The creator is Eru, the One, and also more frequently named Ilúvatar, meaning the father of all, of the universe. It is told in this work that before all else Eru made the Ainur, that were the offspring of his thought, and that they were with him before time. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music. And they sang before him, each one alone, while the rest hearkened. This was the beginning of the music of the Ainur, for Ilúvatar summoned them all, and he declared to them a mighty theme of which they must make in harmony together a great music. When Ilúvatar brought this great music to an end, he made it known to the Ainur that he, being the lord of all, had transformed all that they had sung and played. He had caused them to be, to have shape and reality, as had the Ainur themselves. He led them then out into the darkness. But when they came into the midmost void, they beheld a sight of surpassing beauty, where before had been emptiness. And Ilúvatar said, "Behold your music, for of my will it has taken shape, and even now the history of the world is beginning." I conclude this account with a passage of great significance in this book. There is speech between Ilúvatar and Olmo concerning the realm of the Lord of Waters. Then follows,
"And even as Ilúvatar spoke to Olmo, the Ainur beheld the unfolding of the world, and the beginning of that history which Ilúvatar had propounded to them as a theme of song. Because of their memory of the speech of Ilúvatar, and the knowledge that each has of the music which he played, the Ainur know much of what is to come, and few things are unforeseen by them."
If we set this passage beside the foresight of Olmo concerning Earendel, which I have characterized as miraculous, it seems that Olmo was looking very far back in time to know for a certainty what the near future was portending. There remains a further aspect of the Ainur to notice. To quote the Ainu Lindele once more, it is told that,
"Even as they gazed, many became enamoured of the beauty of the world, and engrossed in the history which came there to being, and there was unrest among them. Thus it came to pass that some abode still with Ilúvatar beyond the world, but others, and among them were many of the wisest and fairest of the Ainur, craved leave of Ilúvatar to enter into the world and dwell there, and put on the form and raiment of time. Then those that wished descended and entered into the world. But this condition Ilúvatar made, that their power should thenceforth be contained and bounded by the world and fail with it. And his purpose with them afterward Ilúvatar has not revealed. Thus the Ainur came into the world, whom we call the Valar, or the Powers, and they dwelt in many places, in the firmament, or in the deeps of the sea, or upon earth, or in Valinor upon the borders of earth. And the four greatest were Melko, and Manwë, and Olmo, and Aule."
This is followed by the portrait of Olmo that is given in the music of the Ainur. It follows from the foregoing that the term Ainur, singular Ainu, may be used in the place of Valar, Vala, now and again. So, for example, "But the Ainur put it into his heart." I must add finally that in this sketch of the music of the Ainur, I have deliberately omitted a major strand in the story of the creation, the huge and destructive part played by Melko, Morgoth. Húrin and Gondolin. This story is found in the relatively late text which my father called the Grey Annals, on which refer to the evolution of the story. It tells that Húrin and his brother Húor, the father of Túor, went both to battle with the orcs. Even Húor, for he would not be restrained, though he was but 13 years of age. And being with a company that was cut off from the rest, they were pursued to the ford of Brithiach. And there they would have been taken or slain, but for the power of Olmo, which was still strong in Sirion. Therefore a mist arose from the river and hid them from their enemies, and they escaped into Dimbar and wandered in the hills beneath the sheer walls of the Chrysaigrim. There Thorondor espied them and sent 2 eagles that took them and bore them up and brought them beyond the mountains to the secret vale of Tumladen and the hidden city of Gondolin, which no man else yet had seen. King Turgon welcomed them, for Olmo had counselled him to deal kindly with the house of Hador, whence help should come at need. They dwelt in Gondor a year, and it is said that at this time Húrin learned something of the counsels and purposes of Turgon, for he had a great liking for them, and wished to keep them in Gondolin. But they desired to return to their own kin, and share in the wars and griefs that now beset them. Turgon yielded to their wish, and he said, "By the way that you came, you have leave to depart, if Thorondor is willing. I grieve at this parting. Yet in a little while, as the Eldar account it, we may meet again." The story ends with the hostile words of Maeglin, who greatly opposed the king's generosity towards them. "The law is become less stern than aforetime," he said, "or else no choice would be given you but to abide here to your life's end." To this Húrin replied that if Maeglin did not trust them, they would take oaths, and they swore never to reveal the counsels of Turgon, and to keep secret all that they had seen in his realm. Years later, Tuol would say to Voronwë as they stood beside the sea at Vinyamar, "But as for my right to seek Turgon, I am Tuol, son of Huol, and kin to Húrin, whose names Turgon will not forget." Húrin was taken alive in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Morgoth offered him his freedom, or else power as the greatest of Morgoth's captains, if he would but reveal where Turgon had his stronghold. This proposal Húrin refused to Morgoth's face, with utmost boldness and scorn. Then Morgoth set him in a high place of Thangor Odrim, to sit there upon a chair of stone, and he said to Húrin that, seeing with the eyes of Morgoth, he should look out upon the evil fates of those he loved, and nothing would escape him. Húrin endured this for 28 years. At the end of that time, Morgoth released him. He feigned that he was moved by pity for an enemy utterly defeated, but he lied. He had further evil purpose, and Húrin knew that Morgoth was without pity. But he took his freedom. In this extension of the grey annals in which this story is told, the wanderings of Húrin, he came at length to the Ikoriath, the encircling mountains of Gondolin. But he could find no way further, and he stood at last in despair before the stern silence of the mountains. He stood at last upon a great stone, and spreading wide his arms, looking towards Gondolin, he called in a great voice, "Turgon! Húrin calls you! O Turgon, will you not hear in your hidden halls?" But there was no answer, and all that he heard was wind in the dry grasses. Yet there were ears that had heard the words that Húrin spoke, and eyes that marked well his gestures, and report of all came soon to the dark throne in the north. Then Morgoth smiled, and knew now clearly in what region Turgon dwelt, though, because of the eagles, no spy of his could yet come within sight of the land behind the encircling mountains. So here again we meet my father's shifting perception of how Morgoth discovered where the hidden kingdom lay. The story in the present text is clearly at odds with the passage in the Cuenta Noldor Inua, where the treachery of Maeglin, taken prisoner by the orcs, is told in this clear form: "He purchased his life and freedom by revealing unto Morgoth the place of Gondolin and the ways whereby it might be found and assailed. Great indeed was the joy of Morgoth." The story was, in fact, I think, now taking a further step in the light of the end of the passage given above, where Húrin's cries revealed the place of Gondolin to the joy of Morgoth. This is seen from what my father added at this point in the manuscript.
"Later, when captured and Maeglin wished to buy his release with treachery, Morgoth must answer laughing, saying, 'Stale news will buy nothing. I know this already. I am not easily blinded.' So Maeglin was obliged to offer more to undermine resistance in Gondolin."
Iron Mountains. At first sight, it appeared from early texts that Hissa-Lurmi, Hithlum was a region distinct from the later Hithlum, since it was placed beyond the Iron Mountains. I concluded, however, that what was involved was simply a change of names, and this is certainly the truth of the matter. It is told elsewhere in the Lost Tales that after the escape of Melko from his imprisonment in Valinor, he made for himself new dwellings in that region of the north where stand the Iron Mountains, very high and terrible to see. And also that Angband lay beneath the roots of the northernmost fortresses of the Iron Mountains. Those mountains were so named from the hells of iron beneath them. The explanation is that the name Mountains of Iron was originally applied to the range later called Shadowy Mountains, or Mountains of Shadow, Eredwythrin. It might be that while these mountains were regarded as a continuous range, the southern extension, the southern and eastern walls of Hithlum, came to be distinguished in name from the terrible northern peaks above Angband, the mightiest of them being Thangorodrim. Unhappily, I failed to alter the list of names in the entry Hissolome in Beren and Luthien, which states that the region owes its name to the scanty sun which peeps over the Iron Mountains to the east and south of it. In the present text of the tale, I have replaced iron by shadowy. Nirnaeth Arnoediad, The Battle of Unnumbered Tears. It is said in the Quenta Noldorinwa,
"Now it must be told that Maedhros, son of Feanor, perceived that Morgoth was not unassailable after the deeds of Huan and Luthien, and the breaking of the towers of Thu."
Tol Sirion, Isle of Werewolves, later changed to Sauron's Tower.
"But that he would destroy them all, one by one, if they did not form again a league and council. This was the union of Maedhros, and wisely planned."
The gigantic battle that ensued was the most disastrous in the history of the wars of Beleriand. References to the Nirnaeth Arnoediad abound in the texts, for elves and men were utterly defeated, and the ruin of the Noldor was achieved. Fingon, king of the Noldor, a son of Fingolfin and brother of Turgon, was slain, and his realm was no more. But a very notable event early in the battle was the intervention of Turgon, breaking the leaguer of Gondolin. This event is told thus in the Grey Annals, on which refer to the evolution of the story.
"To the joy and wonder of all, there was a sounding of great trumpets, and there marched up to war a host unlooked for. This was the army of Turgon that issued from Gondolin, 10,000 strong, with bright mail and long swords, and they were stationed southwards, guarding the passes of Sirion."
There is also in the Grey Annals a very noteworthy passage on the subject of Turgon and Morgoth.
"But one thought troubled Morgoth deeply and marred his triumph. Turgon had escaped the net, whom he most desired to take. For Turgon came of the great house of Fingolfin, and was now by right king of all the Noldor. And Morgoth feared and hated most the house of Fingolfin, because they had scorned him in Valinor, and had the friendship of Ulmo, and because of the wounds that Fingolfin gave him in battle. Moreover, of old his eye had lighted on Turgon, and a dark shadow fell on his heart, foreboding that in some time that lay yet hidden in doom, from Turgon ruin should come to him."
The Origins of Eärendil. The text that follows here is derived from a lengthy letter written by my father in 1967 on the subject of his construction of names within his history and his adoption of names exterior to his history. He remarked at the outset that the name Eärendil, the later form, was very plainly derived from the Old English word Eärendel, a word that he felt to be of peculiar beauty in that language. "Also," he continued, "its form strongly suggests that it is in origin a proper name and not a common noun." From related forms in other languages, he thought it certain that it belonged to astronomical myth and was the name of a star or star group.
"To my mind, the Old English uses seem plainly to indicate that it was a star presaging the dawn. At any rate, in English tradition, that is what we call Venus, the morning star, as it may be seen shining brilliantly in the dawn before the actual rising of the sun. That is, at any rate, how I took it. Before 1914, I wrote a poem upon Earendel, who launched his ship like a bright spark from the havens of the sun. I adopted him into my mythology, in which he became a prime figure as a mariner, eventually as a herald star, and a sign of hope to men. Aia Earendil Elenion an Kalimar, hail Earendel, brightest of stars, is derived at long remove from Eala Earendel Englar Beortast.
It was indeed a long remove. These old English words are taken from the poem Christ, which reads at this point, Eala Earendel Englar Beortast, or for Midanyird Monum Ascended. But extraordinary as it seems at first sight, in the Elvish words Aia Earendel Elenion and Kalimar, cited by my father in this letter, he was referring to a passage in the chapter Shelob's Lair in The Lord of the Rings. As Shelob approached Sam and Frodo in the darkness, Sam cried out,
"The lady's gift, the starglass, a light to you in dark places," she said it was to be. The starglass!
In amazement at his forgetfulness,
slowly Frodo's hand went to his bosom, and slowly he held aloft the phial of Galadriel. The darkness receded from it until it seemed to shine in the centre of a globe of airy crystal, and the hand that held it sparkled with white fire. Frodo gazed in wonder at this marvellous gift that he had so long carried, not guessing its full worth and potency. Seldom had he remembered it on the road until they came to Morgul Vale, and never had he used it for fear of its revealing light.
Aia Earendil Elenion an Kalimar, he cried,
and knew not what he had spoken, for it seemed that another voice spoke through his, clear, untroubled by the foul air of the pit.
In the letter of 1967, my father went on to say that
the name could not be adopted just like that. It had to be accommodated to the Elvish linguistic situation, at the same time as a place for this person was made in legend. From this, far back in the history of Elvish, which was beginning after many tentative starts in boyhood to take definite shape at the time of the name's adoption, arose eventually the common Elvish stem Aia, sea, primarily applied to the Great Sea of the West, and the verbal element Indil, meaning to love, be devoted to. Earendil became a character in the earliest written 1916-17 of the major legends. Tuor had been visited by Ulmo, one of the greatest Valar, the lord of seas and waters, and sent by him to Gondolin. The visitation had set in Tuor's heart an insatiable sea longing, hence the choice of name for his son, to whom this longing was transmitted.
The Prophecy of Mandos. In the extract from the sketch of the mythology given in the prologue, it is told that as the Noldali sailed from Valinor in their rebellion against the Valar, Mandos sent an emissary who, speaking from a high cliff as they sailed by, warned them to return, and when they refused, he spoke the prophecy of Mandos concerning their fate in after days. I give here a passage that gives an account of it. The text is the first version of the Annals of Valinor, the last version being the Grey Annals, on which refer to the evolution of the story. This earliest version belongs to the same period as the Quenta Noldorinwa.
They, the departing Noldali, came to a place where a high rock stands above the shores, and there stood either Mandos or his messenger, and spoke the doom of Mandos. For the kinslaying he cursed the house of Feanor, and to a less degree all who followed them or shared in their emprise, unless they would return to abide the doom and pardon of the Valar. But if they would not, then should evil fortune and disaster befall them, and ever from treachery of kin towards kin, and their oath should turn against them, and a measure of mortality should visit them, that they should be lightly slain with weapons or torments or sorrow, and in the end fade and wane before the younger race. And much else he foretold darkly that after befell, warning them that the Valar would fence Valinor against their return. But Feanor hardened his heart and held on, and so also but reluctantly did Fingolfin's folk, feeling the constraint of their kindred and fearing for the doom of the gods. For not all of Fingolfin's house had been guiltless of the kinslaying.
Refer also to the words of Olmo to Tuor at Vinyamar in the last version. The Three Kindreds of the Elves in The Hobbit. In The Hobbit, not far from the end of Chapter 8, Flies and Spiders, occurs this passage.
The feasting people were wood elves, of course. They differed from the high elves of the West and were more dangerous and less wise. For most of them, together with their scattered relations in the hills and mountains, were descended from the ancient tribes that never went to Faerie in the West. There the light elves and the deep elves and the sea elves went and lived for ages, and grew fairer and wiser and more learned, and invented their magic and their cunning craft in the making of beautiful and marvellous things, before some came back into the wide world.
These last words refer to the rebellious Noldor, who left Valinor and in Middle-earth became known as the Exiles.
That was The Fall of Gondolin by J.R.R. Tolkien. Edited by Christopher Tolkien. Read by Timothy West and Samuel West. This program was produced by the RNIB, a HarperCollins audiobook. All text and materials by J.R.R. Tolkien, copyright The Tolkien Estate, 2018. Preface, notes, and all other materials, copyright C.R. Tolkien, 2018. Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. The proprietor, on behalf of the author and the editor, hereby assert their respective moral rights to be identified as the author of the work.
Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.